So this afternoon, we've got the GRA SML deal. We've got fuel shortages that we are witnessing in some parts of the city. And of course, we start off with, this particular matter. Now, this afternoon, government has come under criticism about the arrest of Hobson Adoye. And, what you are seeing on the screen, this was the period where Hobson Adoye was being taken to the court for his plea to be taken. Adoye was picked up yesterday on charges of publishing false news when he claimed in a radio interview that he detonated dynamite in the voter region during the 2016 presidential and parliamentary elections. Now, he's been put before court and granted bail, which conditions he's working around the clock to satisfy. But his legal team said the arrest and detention is nothing but politics and a desperate attempt by the governing MPP to divert the attention of Ghanaians from the bad press it has received within the last few weeks. Yabo Abena Samoa is his lawyer and has been speaking with my colleague Latif Idris at the Dansoman Circuit Court where the case was heard.
Part of the execution is that the investigator is satisfied the sureties are where they can find them. Okay. So now they are on a quest to look out at where the sureties live. And after they are satisfied that the sureties can be traced, they will come back to the court to sign. And that will mean the execution of the bail bond upon which Mr. Hobson Adoye will be released. I believe traffic conditions permitting, within the hour, they should be here.
From where you sit, do you think you are in the position to get him to execute
the bill?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Once the court has granted bail, the police are cooperating. And together with the police, we're sure to execute the bail before close of the working day.
Let's come back to the charges. What do you make of the charges preferred against your client?
I'd rather not go there because it's still in process. In fact, they are not very firm about what they are doing or saying. They still say they are investigating, and that there was a provisional charge of publication of false information under Section 28. I don't think it's a very strong thing that they are doing. Basically, this is politics. I mean, let's be frank. This is politics. This is politics. Mr. Adoye has of late been a bit critical of MPP government's performance, and he's been particularly acerbic about some of the incidents that happened before. This, if you listen carefully to the tape that the police are seeking to rely on, he's heard distinctly on that tape telling the people he was speaking to that he had informed the president. That he had informed the president about this incident. And at the time, he was a candidate. So it means before the president became president, he knew what was happening and whatever Mr. Adoye was doing or was either helping others to do or inadvertently happening to get involved in or otherwise. The president knew. Now you come to power, and in 8 years, this is not the first time Mr. Adoye has mentioned this matter. But at the time, he was part of the MPP and speaking for the MPP.
Like yourself.
It was convenient for the government. How do you say the MPP? It was convenient for the government. You know, you have this dichotomy where individuals ride on the back of political organizations like the MPP and DC and then get elected and then they use power for their own benefit. That's the bottom line. So the government, which came out of the MPP, found it convenient at the time not to bother with Mr. Adoye's pronouncements. Now, suddenly, they realize Mr. Adoye is a thorn in the flesh of the government. And is pushing the movement for change, the agenda of the movement for change for an independent president, a president who will work for Ghana, who will not depend on the partisan separation of the authority of the state. And because of that, given the headway that is being made, the temptation is to strike him and see if you can reduce his effectiveness, literally shut him up, but it won't work. And this is a mere attempt at muscling Mr. Adoye. It won't work.
You mentioned that this is pure politics, but the prosecution has a contrary view. They say because he mentioned that he sponsored five other people to carry out this explosion within the border town, it hinges on national security. That shouldn't be taken lightly.
A prosecution shouldn't be taken heavily. You rather be taken lightly. This is not the first time this matter has come up. And when you have a police prosecution and you are told before you come to court by the police that they are waiting for instructions from above before they conclude their investigations, then you realize that it is politics. That's what I'm saying. What national security thing is there about what they said happened in Togo and it's been going on since 2016? What is supposed to have happened in 2016? They didn't realize for the past 8 years that national security was threatened. When Mr. Adoye was speaking for the government of the MPP, they didn't realize that he was threatening national security. So when did they realize that Mr. Adoye was a threat to national security? After he became a member of the Movement for Change? When did he become a threat? The incident that happened in 2016 has become a threat to national security now. Is that what the prosecution is saying?
Because
it's a joke.
Because it's gone
it
public.
Is a joke. It's been public all this while. Let's not waste our time on these BB political things. It's appalling. It's pitiful to try and muscle the Movement for Change through this process. It can't stop anybody. This is not a banana republic. This is a democracy. This is not acceptable anymore. That partisanship based on which Mr. Adoye has been attacked, it's not acceptable anymore, because somebody sitting in the government of the MPP, somebody in government believes that Obisi Adoye's current posture is a threat to the survival of that government, and therefore he must be attacked. It is only in the interest of the government, and it's not even in the interest of the MPP. It only inures to the benefit of the members of the larger party. It only inures to the benefit of a few people within government who are benefiting from the authority and power that the party has given them. So it's politics, but it won't stop the Movement for Change. I have been away, and I told you, he said he told the president, didn't he? So why are you now asking me to
invest? He said
yes.
We have no means of
they also say he said something on air. That's why they are attacking him. You want to believe what he said on air, but you don't want to believe what he said he told the president. You want to pick and choose what you want to believe. It's a charade. It's not my business to evaluate Mr. Adoye. It's my business to look at where this is leading Ghana. It's leading us nowhere. You can't pick and choose victims and use power against those victims because they are politically not aligned with you. You can't do politically motivated things in the name of national security and create the impression somebody is a threat to national security when all along you've been with that person and you know that you knew, and over 8 years all of a sudden the person becomes a threat to national security because you don't want to know him anymore. That is not my business.
Your campaign train has been very busy crisscrossing the country. How is this matter going to impact or derail the train, if you like?
You want to derail?
I don't want to derail. I'm only asking
you to be derailed. Your question
is, he's a key member of your movement.
Derailed. Yesterday he was invited in Accra. Today he's gotten bail. We're moving on. We are doing our own thing. Well, why are you thinking derailment? Derailment means that the government succeeds. Mr. Adoye is arrested, so the entire Movement for Change comes crashing down. The entire Alliance for Revolutionary Change comes crashing down. Don't forget, Movement for Change is part of an alliance. This is a broad range of interests who are coming together to change the political system, to break the duopoly down, this dominant duopoly of 32 years, so that we make headway in terms of what we choose to do with Ghana's future as a people. So it's bigger than an individual. It's a movement. It's a social movement. It's bigger than one person, but a lot of individuals come together and are working together to contribute to the success of the process for changing the political paradigm we have in Ghana at the moment. So the Alliance for Revolutionary Change is on course. The Movement for Change, which is led by Mr. Chemartin within the alliance. And indeed, Mr. Chemartin is a presidential candidate of the alliance. It's on course to change the politics of this country.
In some few seconds ago, you mentioned what I want to call some excesses of the regime. Is that why you left the party to begin with?
Let's not go back to that.
That's history. I'm not interested in what happened with the party before and why I left and all that. That's history. Everybody knows why I left.
Yes. I've also pointed out these very areas of Hope Sinadero. Is one is a diversionary tactic, so as it were, divert issues that are happening in the country as we speak. You should say something.
It's the truth. What's happening with the SNET divestitures, what's happening with the SML, publication of the full SML report, are things that the government really wants to run away from. And the belief is that this will divert public attention. It's what is called a dead cat in journalism. I'm sure you guys are aware of what a dead cat is, where you float something funny and then it diverts everybody from. By the time we all come back to it, then this will not be news anymore. So it is a diversion. What is going down is dirty. The SML report is bad. It's dirty. The SNET situation is bad. It's dirty. And the government wants to move away from those things with sensationalism. Arrest Hope Sinadero. Everybody is talking about it. After 1 week, everybody would have forgotten the debt in the SML, the debt in SNET.
Right, so let's speak the very latest on this matter. Let me bring in Nana Yao Sapon. He's a member of the Movement for Change and he joins us via Nana Yao, good afternoon. And welcome. So is Mr. Hope Sinadero free now in terms of meeting his bail condition? Has he met all the conditions set in?
Thank you very much, my brother, and good afternoon to your viewers and your all Ghanaians across the world who are actually watching. And yes, as it stands, Mr. Hope Sinadero has been able to meet the bail conditions. As you may know or you're aware, now the bail condition had to do with two sureties plus a two 20,000 Ghana cedis testified.
Right.
Yes, and then we've been able to meet all of those conditions as stands now. We thank God for it. We in the Movement for Change as stands as we say that we're not moved by what you're doing. We are not intimidated. Of course, we know that whatever is happening is politically motivated. And we are steadfast. We stand as Ghanaians. As the president said in his inaugural speech, he says that we should be citizens and not be spectators. We are being citizens and we are going to resist the oppressor's rule. We are marching forward and we are very much focused.
But the reason for the arrest is quite established. Why do you say it's politically motivated?
The reason for the arrest is publication of falsehood. Now, this is an incident that happened, the claim happened in 2016. Now, is this the first person to make such a statement? In recent time, one of the very top or senior men in the NPP was on one of the network stations, said that when he was youth leader, when he was an organizer, he campaigned throughout the length and breadth of this nation. He said that he knows every single ghetto in this country. He knows all the criminals in this country. He knows where the armed robbers meet. But this person is around. He's not gone anywhere. The police has not invited. We were in this country. Somebody made a claim on one of the stations. I think I'm told he currently works with Ghana Gas. He said that the late Evans Jonathan Mills, His Excellency, was murdered. He says that if the police do not know, he dies because somebody benefited from the death of His Excellency, the former president. The person is still walking free. People have made much more daring and incriminating statements that are there. What did Hobson say? What actually did Hobson say? In any case, he was not arrested yesterday. He was invited. If not for what they did, if not for the games they played with us from 12 noon yesterday, Hobson wouldn't have slept in the cells. For a publication of falsehood is the least of all crimes.
But look at it this way. The pictures we are seeing on our screens is Hope seen in handcuff, being treated like some hardened criminal.
Like a criminal. And
you are making light of this issue?
No, so you put him in handcuff when you have not even charged him. You put him in handcuff as if he's a murderer. You put him in handcuff as if he's committed some high treason. In today's Ghana, where we have a certain president who is a human rights lawyer, they've not been fair to Hobson Adoye, they've not been fair to Movement for Change. And we see this as a tactical way of intimidating us, but we don't mind. We are not intimidated, not at all. Not when we have come this far. And not when Ghanaians are ready to change the viewpoint. Not when Ghanaians are ready to accept the great transformational plan instead of the normal and usual manifesto promises. Not when the Ghanaians are ready to bring on board somebody as president who can have an impact, a positive impact to changing the economy. The city is a dollar to a city is about 15 cities, 35 persons. That is what we should be arresting. Mm. And not somebody who has sat on radio to make a claim that you cannot even establish.
Just a quick question here. So the movement says that they want to break this duopoly between the MPP and the NDC. They want to come out as refined politicians who are after the interests and the betterment of the Ghanaian people, and of course the development.
And that is what we are doing.
The development of this country. But comments like these, comments that has landed Hope Sin Adoye in trouble. I mean, you can't classify these comments as comments that
Hobson was telling from a group
that is seeking to deviate from the policies
that
we've
been using. What you are failing to understand is that Hobson was telling the story of yesterday. Hobson was telling a story when he was uncircumcised. Hobson was telling a story when he was un-Christian. Now he's a born-again Christian. And
so he's confessing
his
sins.
Yesterday, this is what he did. He was telling us a story that yesterday this is what occurred. And as a changed being as he is, he's moving forward and he's repented. That is my understanding. That is how I saw it. I mean, listening to the tape, he was telling a story. And so if I come to you and I'm telling you that when I was Mr. A, this is what we did, and because I am Mr. B, my leader, even in that conversation, you will notice that that was when he made a statement that he was asked to take off the siren on his car. He didn't want to take it off, but the leader called him and said that, listen, this is not how we're going to go about things. This is a new era. We are preaching to Ghanaians that we are new. We are preaching to Ghanaians that we are bringing something more positive and should be more focused. Take it off. They said we should apply. We have applied. It's not responded. Reapply. We would play the game by the rules. I mean, we are law-abiding citizens. Alain Tremantin is a fine gentleman. You know. I mean, you've been in the media space for some time now. You know he's a fine gentleman. You know that he will not allow his followers to do things that are not unlawful. You know he will not allow that. And he's one politician who can hit his chest to say that he's incorrupt. And one politician who can hit his chest to say that he has never been negative towards anybody.
And so, does it in any way affect the movement in terms of your plans and programs going forward? Knowing very well that he may not be back in court?
I'll not even let you know. Not at all. We are focused. We are in high spirit. We are moving forward. We are the Movement for Change. We are bringing a change to Ghanaians, and Ghanaians are ready. They are accepting our change, and that is what is shocking some people. I mean, I think that some people is expected us to get to the extent we have gotten to. I am thinking that they anticipated that by now the Movement for Change would have been empty, but every single day we increase in numbers, every single day we increase in strategy, every single day they see Ghanaians accepting us, and they see us winning, and that is what they are scared of. They are running away from the truth, from their shadows, and they think they can intimidate us. No, not at all. We are moving. We're going. The train is on. And we, as we speak, our leader has been invited to meet the Association of Ghana Industries. He's going to present to them his plan and what he has for the industrial Ghana, and what he has in plan to move Ghana forward. Right, so we are very much
But my final question, so when are you doing in court, and hopes him ready to defend his charges in court?
The lawyers are handling that. He was granted bail. I think that he presented a date to the judge, and so it will be agreed on, and we'll go back to court, and then whatever procedure that is there will follow.
All right, Nana Safwan, thank you very much. He's a leading member of the movement. Yes, of the Movement for Change. And the news this afternoon is that finally, Hobson Adore, arrested and put before court, they granted bail, has met all the bail condition, and is now home. And the developing on this matter is that they are due back in court, hopefully somewhere next week, and he says that he will be there to defend himself. That is the news this afternoon. Another story we are keeping an eye on is a reported shortage of fuel in some pumps, in some fuel stations. We are live on the ground to meet the very latest, and this is related to the action taken by the tanker drivers union. They are on strike. They started a strike on Tuesday, protesting against what they describe as poor working conditions. The MPA, the OMC, they've all tried to step in. The matter remained unresolved. And this afternoon, we are picking information that some fuel stations are beginning to run out of products. We'll be live on the ground to bring the very latest. But another burning issue that broke last night and is still a raging matter in the country is the KPMG SML report. Now, civil society organizations are making a fresh push for the termination of the SML revenue assurance deal with the Ghana Revenue Authority. They are also demanding the prosecution of states and SML officials who were involved in the execution of this deal. This demand follows the publication of the full KPMG report by the presidency. The report, among others, revealed that the GRA, that's Ghana Revenue Authority, board did not deliberate or approve the deal, especially the contract signed in 2018 and 2019. We'll hear from the civil society organization shortly. But first, though, my colleague Kwaku Asante joins me with details from this over 300-page report that the presidency finally made it available. So, Kwaku, you're welcome.
Thank you.
First, what did KPMG find regarding the fees paid to SML? There's been controversy about whether the money is 1 billion.
Well, I would recall that about 2 weeks ago, when the presidency published their white paper on this audit report and the findings that KPMG had done, at the time they had not published fully what KPMG had submitted to them. They did submit that KPMG had told them that SML had been paid a little over 1 billion Ghana cedis. If you look at the report today, the presidency's recollection of how things went is not incorrect, but there are those who say that that is not a full picture.
Right.
Because if you look at the report, the gross amount, that is the total amount DRA has paid without the taxes and everything, is 1.4 billion Ghana cedis.
Mm-hmm.
That is how much the SML has gotten under the performance of the contract. All the work they've done since it was signed, they've gotten 1.4 billion Ghana cedis. That is the gross. However, the net, that is if you deduct all the charges, taxes, and every other amounts that SML would have to pay back to the state, that will lead you to 1 billion and 61 million Ghana cedis.
In fact, when I spoke to the SML head of strategy on this show, she mentioned the same.
Exactly.
That GR actually took all the taxes before they were paid.
Exactly. So that 1 billion Ghana cedis is what the presidency referred. So there's that, and civil society organizations have lodged on it. But the clarification is that there's a gross amount, there's a net amount. The gross amount is 1.4 billion Ghana cedis. However, if you net it with all the deductions, it comes up to about 1 billion Ghana cedis.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what GRA has gotten since this contract was started.
There's also this controversy about SML not paying some taxes to the state.
Well, we know that between 2018 and 2019, some amounts were paid to SML as part of the performance of this, and in particular between 1st September 2020 and 30th April 2021, some bulk payments were made to SML. In fact, on some points, SML had taken money from the state for the work they had done, and GRA had collected the taxes. Mm-hmm. But on this particular point, between 1st September 2020 and 30th April 2021, the bulk payment that went to SML, the GRA did not deduct the tax. Of course, that is the responsibility of GRA, that
of
when
course.
You are paying this, you need to deduct this withholding taxes. That's what they are called, withholding taxes. GRA did not. And so that at the time amounted to about 13.38 million Ghana cedis. And because it has not been paid and GRA had not collected that money, there has been some penalties accruing on top of this. And all this has led to some 18.5 million Ghana cedis as penalty on this 13.38 million Ghana cedis. In total, that is 31.88 million Ghana cedis that GRA will now go and collect from SML as a withholding tax and a penalty. And KPMG makes the point in this report that they have to draw GRA attention that within this particular point, and contrary to everything that you always do by withholding these taxes, within this time frame, you did not collect these taxes. And so we understand now that GRA has written to SML.
So this is a blame on GRA.
This is a blame
for
on
for not GRA doing their work in terms of, you know, taking the tax.
These are withholding taxes. For instance, if you have to pay any money to certain persons, and the law mandates you to take the withholding taxes, you have to take that before you make the payment, right? And so GRA ought to have done that, and GRA did not do it. And so some penalties will not have to be imposed on that. Obviously, being a tax issue, there can be a negotiation because GRA had to collect it. They didn't collect it. And now you're asking these people to pay a penalty on it. And so they have to find some middle ground on that. And we understand now that there have been a subsequent communication with SML demanding settlement of this outstanding amount.
There are also issues about approvals that SML may not have gotten between 2018 and 2019. Walk us through these approvals.
Again, this is also the responsibility of GRA to secure these approvals. They are in three tiers. There is the parliamentary bit, there is the PPA bit, and there is also the board bit. If you start from the very top, parliament, it is the responsibility of the GRA when signing this, what is called a multi-year commitment agreement, to go through the finance ministry and go to parliament and get parliamentary ratification of this deal that GRA did not do. In fact, if you look at Section 33 of the Public Financial Management Act, it is clear that an entity must seek ministerial and parliamentary approval when it is entering into an agreement with financial commitments that binds the government of Ghana for more than 1 year. If you look at this contract, it's a multi-year contract. And so clearly, they have to go to parliament. As we know now, that hasn't gone to parliament. And then there's the PPA.
But the point is that the matter not going to parliament.
It's GRA.
I mean, SML has no locus on the floor.
Definitely.
Even GRA may not have locus on the floor.
They have to go to the finance.
The Ministry of Finance. So if this requires parliamentary approval and it was not done, then the blame goes to the finance ministry.
Yeah.
At this stage, we don't know whether GRA advised finance ministry to put this application before parliament for ratification, or they did not.
In fact, these are some of the things that we'll be expecting that GRA would have to clarify in terms of explaining, because it is obvious from KPMG's report that they did get ministerial approval. That is, the finance ministry consented to them entering this agreement. However, the parliamentary bid did not happen, and clearly SML cannot come to parliament. It's a private organization. They have no locals, they have no business there. The GRA can do so through the finance ministry, what is their supervisory ministry, but that has not been done, and so we'll get some information on that. So PPA,
right?
Again, on three different occasions, that time SML was called SMEL. The GRA goes to PPA on three different occasions to get them to actually consent to this deal. PPA on all three different occasions does not grant that, and GRA still goes ahead anyway to sign some sales contracts, transaction audit service, contract extension, price verification service, consolidation service agreement, measurement of audit downstream petroleum products, and addendum to measurement audit for downstream petroleum products. All these had to go to PPA before, but PPA did not approve. So GRA found a convenient way to do that by subsuming this agreement under an existing agreement with West Blue, so that they will be providing as a service provider. And up to some point, when the West Blue contract expired, they just gave the contract to SML to perform. And
so, on that score, so is it a case that they were able to rectify this approval with the PPA, there's no existing, you know, agreement, so, you know, binding this contract between SML and GRA as of now?
We know that later on, when SML actually changed their name at some point, and on 1st January 2019, they got PPA approval to do the work now. But on that previous occasion, they did it. But ultimately, on January 1, 2019, then GRA was able to get PPA's approval to now sign on to this deal. But prior to that, all the contracts that had been signed did not receive PPA approval. Then the final approval that they had to seek, that is the board. And according to the KPMG report, the board of the Ghana Revenue Authority did not deliberate. They did not discuss this at all. And then KPMG.
Is there a time frame for? Does it provide time frame?
It does say that right from the start there was nothing of the sort. And in fact, between 2018 and 2019, none of these went to the board for deliberation. It would then mean that
probably a management
after that that has gone. But GRA then explains that the reason why they didn't go to the board was that the board had decided that if you're extending contracts that did not go beyond 4 million Ghana cedis, you don't have to go to the board.
Okay.
And at the time, some of those contracts they signed were exactly 4 million Ghana cedis or below, for which reason they did not go to the board for approval.
There's also KPMG reports that suggest that SML did some work that led to some increase in revenue to the states. Brief us on that.
Right. So based on the analysis using the ESLA, that is the Energy Sector Levy Act, the reported liftings per pre-SML, that is the dates that predate the period before SML came into the petroleum sector, it was seen that it was an increment reported volume that is attributed to the involvement of SML and is determined by 1.7 billion liters for that period. So if you look at the work that SML did, and the incremental revenue that is attributable to the involvement of SML is 2.45 billion Ghana cedis for the period. And so within that period, the work that SML did per KPMG report was able to save the state about 2.45 billion Ghana cedis, and that is what SML has clearly laid out in its report. Now the fee of this, the state had to pay about 720 million Ghana cedis to SML for the same period. It constituted about 29.41% of the incremental value. KPMG's opinion was that that amount of money could have been negotiated downwards a little bit, but KPMG establishes that about 2.45 billion Ghana cedis revenue accrued to the state because of the work SML did.
I remember the president's white paper on this before this report was made public. The president's statement concluded that, I mean, he had not taken anything out or added anything to the recommendation of the KPMG, and that he's only implemented what KPMG has said should be done in terms of the recommendation. As you have gone through this, does it that this situate well in what the president said in that statement earlier?
Well, yes. In fact, the only difference from the summary of the presidency's report have to do with the 1 billion and 1.4 billion. And even again, when it comes to that, there's explanation as to whether you are quoting the net or the gross amount of money involved in this deal. So it appears the presidency's summary of KPMG's report is there. But of course, the people like Manasseh Azuawuni, for instance, will see that the report is more damning because of certain findings towards it. But this is the generality of it. Again, KPMG, just like the presidency recommended, that they should renegotiate certain terms.
And which I'm told is ongoing.
And if you cancel this, you have to pay SML the return on their investment, the investment that they've made into this situation. You have to pay that. And so we like you've just stated, we understand some negotiations are underway now to try and reach some compromise. And when Parliament resumes also, we understand that there'll be efforts to put those part of the deal that should have gone to Parliament back to Parliament so that they can ratify it.
I remember when Samuel Atachan led the chairman of the Mines and Energy Committee, led some members of the committee to the SMS operational area at Tema, and the comments that he passed. And then we also do understand that the committee, they've indicated that they want to also probe into this matter. Do you have an update on where they are?
We understand now that they themselves had written to the president asking for this report for their work. Obviously, now the presidency have published this, and so the presidency would not even have to give them any other report because this is now a public document that Parliament can access. We understand that the Mines and Energy Committee is looking within the next 1 week to start doing some good work on this, because it will be recalled that in December, Parliament resolved that they were going to investigate this. KPMG have already done their work. There are those who say that it will not be necessary for Parliament to go back into this. But Parliament insists they want to also do some more work on this. And so we understand that in the next 1 week, they are going to start work on this. At the time, the minority insisted that they wanted this to be made public, a public hearing of a sort. We do not have any indication yet what the modalities is for this committee doing its work now. But we understand that within the next 1 week, the Mines and Energy Committee of Parliament, together with the Finance Committee, we'll start an investigation.
Thank you very much. Kokua Sante is our parliamentary correspondent and has been perusing through this over 300-page report by KPMG on the GRA SMS deal. Now, there's been reaction. The NDC has been wading into this controversy. National Chairman of the party, Johnson Esedin Ketia, claims the president published the report because the minority leadership insisted after a meeting with the president on Monday.
It's been released. The president, no, maybe before I entered here, because this morning it was...
The president directed that.
It was a condition that Dr. Atuforson gave.
Right.
When there was a meeting between the president and the leadership of parliament. The president was trying to get their concurrence
on a number of issues.
And the approval of this agreement.
This was part of what the MDC
said. So yeah, we said that look, we suspected there was something wrong, and then we put KPMG there to verify. The report is in. You don't want us to see it, and yet you want us to proceed to go and approve something. So publish it for every Ghanaian to know, so that we see that what you are presenting to Parliament actually contains the corrective actions.
Okay, so this
why
was,
we want to approve.
Yes. Give us this, and we'll also support you. So that was
Interest of the state. Yes,
and that is why.
Yes, and I believe that is why the president has done what he did.
I see. Some also say it has been released at this time to water down the effect of the snit by Nechampo Saga. You don't believe that?
Well, if the president invited the leadership to water down this one, I wouldn't know. But I knew it was a demand that civil society were making, and we were also making.
Are you happy now? Now that it's been released?
We are not going to read the report to know what is contained in there and to be able to decide whether we are comfortable approving anything or not.
So we got more from the MDC National Chair, Johnson Osei-Edun-Ketua, on other matters coming up on the pause this afternoon. But we're taking a short break. When we return, we also have this very disturbing matter of fuel shortages in some parts of the city. We are the very latest on that. Stay right there. This is the pause here on Joy News. We are back on the show. This is the pause here on Joy News. Now, from one controversy to the other, this time the SNIT matter. The controversy surrounding the decision by the Social Security and National Insurance Trust SNIT to sell off some of its stake in four hotels to the Food and Agricultural Minister, Bernard Champon, Information Minister, Fatima Abubakar, is defending the recent deal between SNIT and Rock City, saying it will aid in restructuring SNIT and facilitating its recovery during a courtesy call on the Multimedia Group Limited, aimed at engaging the ministry stakeholders and outlining current programs being implemented. The minister urged the public to view the owner of Rock City Hotel not merely as a cabinet minister, but as a dedicated Ghanaian investor committed to enhancing these properties and supporting SNIT growth.
If there was a decision over 5 years by the fund managers that we want to divest, let us get other people who are able to inject capital so that these facilities are revamped, they are fixed in such a way that they will be competitive and generate more revenue. It's a good thing to do. Most of the successful businesses, when it comes to state-owned interests, you realize that the current trends everywhere is that they are running JVs, joint ventures, bring other people with capital, give them some shares. Also, not just about the money that they inject in, but also the technical capacity. It is not given that if you're a fund manager, you also have expertise in running hotels. So for sustainable models to run, it is also important that you bring people who have experience and who have capacity to run. And it is also interesting that people have forgotten that Rock City is now known as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, hotel facility in the sub-region. If that is the case, the kind of market they are drawing, the goodwill, the branding that they have, the facilities that they have put up, is a testament to the fact that competitively, just as any other hospitality company, they have capacity to bid. If these are open calls, published in newspapers for everyone with interest to also come and show interest, and then all of a sudden, because a Ghanaian, irrespective of political parties, a Ghanaian with capacity and with the means to inject capital and take some shares so that he is able to revamp the businesses, upgrade the assets. And in this Accra, especially now that I'm in the ministry organizing conventions and events, you realize that we need huge investments in the hospitality sector. Have we looked at the processes that SNIT had to go through over the period? Did we have queries? Why were those queries not raised? Is it only because this person is also politically exposed? All of a sudden, his credit score is not taken into consideration, his financial capacity that precedes his political office and even precedes his coming into office as MP, it means nothing. Meaning, so far as you are a business person and you have business interests and investments, if you come into politics to serve the country, all of a sudden you don't qualify to participate in any sector. If we run such models and such commentaries, there is a temptation that the most qualified persons in private sector who have capacity to even come into policy making to say we are coming to make a difference in government will say, you know what, I have enough money, I have enough businesses, let me take care of my business interests and not think about coming to solve any problems in the country. Because he has become a cabinet minister, the portfolio affects his work retrospectively, and all other business interests and engagements that he has must cease. Let us look at it again.
Right, former Director General of SNIT, Ernest Thompson, is calling on the Trust Board to halt the Rock City purchase of a 60% stake of some hotels owned by SNIT. Anti-corruption campaigner Adam Simenu is urging SNIT to abrogate the entire deal. Now, Samuel Harrison Cujo is Programs Officer at the Ghana Anti-Corruption Coalition and joins us for some perspective on this matter. Samuel, you're welcome to the pause. You heard the Information Minister. Are her comments justified?
Well, good afternoon to you and to your viewers. I don't know how the minister is going about her statement this way. Mm. I mean, we are clearly looking at a case of conflict of interest, and she seems to be speaking around that point but failing to acknowledge that indeed there is potential conflict of interest in this whole SNIT Rock City issue. Now, if we look at our constitution, Article 78, which talks about ministers of state, Article 78.3 says that a minister shall not hold any other office of profit or emolument, whether private or public, and whether directly or indirectly.
Ah, the sizzle of McDonald's sausage. It's enough to make you crave your favorite breakfasts. Enough to head over to McDonald's. Enough to make you really wish this commercial were scratch and sniff.
And if you're a sausage person, now get two satisfyingly savory sausage McGriddles, sausage biscuits, or sausage burritos for just $3.33. Or mix and match. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Unless otherwise permitted by the Speaker, acting on the recommendations of a Committee of Parliament on the grounds that A, that holding that office will not prejudice the work of the Minister, and B, that no conflict of interest arises or would arise as a result of the minister holding that office. Mm. Now, here is a minister who is the beneficial owner of Rock City. We haven't been told whether he has divested himself of any interest in Rock City Group. We haven't been informed whether he has placed his interest in Rock City in a blind trust and so has no dealings with it.
He says he's the sole owner, but as of now he doesn't take any salary or emolument from the hotel.
Please, once he is the sole owner, when profit comes, who does it go to? Yes, you don't take salary, but when profit comes, you don't take the profit also, or you have relinquished your ownership of that hotel to someone else. For the real reason, this is a clear case of conflict of interest, and the minister should not even be attempting to explain it away in any other means. Mm. What we feel is that for good reason, SNIT should immediately abrogate the process. Mm. SNIT should be transparent with us regarding all documentation on this deal. In fact, we would even be interested in seeing the other people who came forward and how much they committed to putting in, right? But this whole issue about a Ghanaian and he will not put his money, I mean, it doesn't rush. I think that the minister was speaking around the point. There is potential conflict of interest, and we need to cure that issue.
Let's cheer no longer on the conflict of interest matter. And I want to introduce in another element. Now, the minister owns the hotel. He's the sole owner. He has told us that because of his role as a member of parliament and a minister of state in charge of food and agriculture, cabinet minister, he's not involved in the day-to-day administration of the hotel. So how they run, the money they make, he doesn't come, he doesn't earn a salary. Take away, put aside the SNIT matter. And let's also focus on another angle to this whole narrative. Governments or public events are mostly held at the Rock City. Even as we speak, directors, chief directors are holding a three-day conference at the Rock City. It was opened by President Akufo-Addo yesterday. Parliament has had conferences and seminars at the Rock City. In all of this, you know, contrast and engagement ongoing at the Rock City, do you still think that the element of conflict of interest is probable in these, you know, ongoing engagements where public events are held at a hotel?
Yes, so to the extent that the Minister of State is beneficial owner of the property, he may not be taking salary, but when the company makes any profit, it counts to him. Mm. To the extent that he is beneficial owner of that property, then we are dealing with issues of potential conflict of interest. Now, what the main thing here is that the fact that we have not spoken about other potential conflict of interest situations does not mean that we cannot speak about this one. Mm. You see, so yes, directors and all are doing business with Rock City Hotel. We are not sure what processes they went through and how, I mean, the procurement and how they arrived at it. But in this particular case, with the SNIT issue, we see clearly a potential conflict of interest, and we feel that, I mean, it's about time we sat down to have a conversation about it. And that is also the reason why in our press conference yesterday, we called on the president to send the Conduct of Public Officers Bill to Parliament, mm-hmm. so that we can have this bill passed and have some law governing assets and liability declaration, gift giving, and conflict of interest. I think it's about time the president was bold enough to take that action, because we cannot keep talking about this every day and we do not see any accountability. We do not see anybody being punished for placing themselves in the conflict of interest position. Remember, we had this same conflict of interest thing with the PDSD, where an MP who was said to be a company secretary, and he said he went out during the voting and all of that. I mean, it doesn't end well for us. That is why we are saying that let's abrogate this deal. But beyond that, let's look at systemic changes, pass the Conduct of Public Officers Bill, so that we can situate conflict of interest properly in its place and then deal with it.
So my last question before I let you go. So your suggestion is that SNIT should pull the plugs. This afternoon, we managed to get a circular that is basically telling the management of the four hotels that they should give access to workers of Rock City. I mean, giving indication that the deal is almost at the final stage. And so they should be allowed to inspect what they've been told. I mean, how do you respond to this?
You see, management of SNIT should understand that it is the Ghanaian workers' money that makes SNIT. So when Ghanaian citizens are saying, let's abrogate this deal, let's go through every documentation, let's be sure things are being done right, I think it would have been in their interest if they abrogated the deal and we talked through this properly. You see, like we said yesterday, it may even be a good deal for SNIT. But Senate needs to talk to us whose money makes up the Senate so that we are convinced that we are on the right path. I think that how Senate and I mean management is struggling now is quite unfortunate.
There's too much secret around the Senate.
It's not too late. We are still asking Senate to abrogate the deal and to show levels of transparency by getting us to go through all of this process again so that we are sure that we are getting the best deal for the hotels that they want to divest. But we are still saying that the conflict of interest has to be cured, and that can be done only when we get the president to send the conduct of public officers bill to parliament so it is passed, and then now we can situate it properly and deal with it.
Thank you very much, Sabi, for your time this afternoon. And of course, he is with the anti-corruption coalition, and he spoke about the conduct of the public officers bill. When I had the deputy attorney general in this studio, he promised that they will put it before parliament before the expiration of the 8th parliament. We are already in May, almost about entering June. There is no indication that the bill has been presented to the floor for it to be taken to first reading and subsequent consideration. We'll keep an eye on this matter and report accordingly. But this afternoon, the strike action by the Ghana National Petroleum Tanker Drivers Union is beginning to bite hard as the Tanker Drivers Association says some filling stations in the Western and the Ashanti region have started recording shortages. The drivers laid down their tools on Monday, May 20th, demanded approval of a policy to improve their salaries and working conditions, which they claim has been pending at the National Petroleum Authority since November 2023. Tankers remain grounded across the depot, even though the MPA is expected to meet with the drivers and other stakeholders this very afternoon over the matter. We'll check the reality on the ground. First, though, let me speak to the National Vice Chair of the Ghana National Tankers Drivers Union, Sunday Alabi. Ms. Alabi, so you are on strike. You are sitting home doing nothing. Is that the case?
I'm not connected.
Yes, Ms. Alabi, good afternoon if you can hear me. You are... today is day 3 of the strike, and we are picking information at some fuel stations in the Ashanti and the Western region. They are beginning to record, you know, empty containers. Is it what you anticipated? If you can unmute for me so we can hear you, Ms. Alabi. I trust you can hear me now. All right, so we'll try and reestablish communication with Mr. Sunday Alabi, the vice chair of the Tankers Drivers Union. I will bring him on to understand what is going on. Let me cross over to Nana Latif Drews. My colleague is also out and about checking on the situation. Latif, good afternoon. If you can hear me, where are you and what can you report? Yes, Latif, good afternoon.
So we are coming to you live from the Nima runabout. There is the oil filling station just on the shoulders of the runabout. As you can see on your screens, the price of Super XP is going for $14.55, and diesel is going at $14.70, and Super One going for $15. And this is happening at the fuel station. This is Goyle. This is Goyle. We must emphasize that. Like you mentioned in our intro, Elton, the situation is beginning to bite at the various fuel stations, and this particular one is not excluded. Already I'm picking information that since yesterday, a number of fuel stations have not had any supply. That is a signal that going forward, by tomorrow, if this trend continues, then across the country we are going to be faced with a very serious challenge, which will in the long run affect the economy of this country. I'm joined by Mr. Pepra. He's the manager of this particular fuel station here at the Nima runabout. Mr. Pepra, you are welcome to join us.
Thank you.
Tell us about the impact this strike action by the tanker drivers is having on your business as a manager of this particular oil brand.
Well, the problem is that since yesterday we've not received any product. So if by tomorrow morning we don't get, then we are going to short here. So it is going to have a bad impact on the public.
So per the average and the estimates based on the sales you've had over the years, with what you have underground right now, how many days do you think you're able to supply?
Tomorrow morning we shall short. Tomorrow morning we run down.
You will run out by tomorrow morning,
yeah.
if you don't have any fresh supply.
Yeah, yeah.
Would that affect what we see on the board? I mean the pricing. How is that going to affect the pricing going forward?
In what sense?
So now we see 14.55 for Super XP.
Yeah.
The point I just want to establish is if we get to the point where there is a huge shortage, is that going to affect the prices at the pump?
The price is not affected. It's not affected.
So what is the call by people like you? You are in the industry, you are major players, to these tanker drivers. Without them, it appears that your business is not going to run.
Yeah. I'll appeal to the authorities who are in charge of the problems of the tanker drivers to try to resolve it so that they can come back to work.
But your one key player or stakeholder is the MPA. They say they didn't employ these tanker drivers.
No. It's the tanker owners that employ the drivers. So we have to come to a compromise and see how best we can come together and solve this problem.
Are you hopeful that this is going to be resolved soon?
I can't tell. I can't tell because I'm not a member of the committee who are planning this thing all together.
As managers of these various stations, how much voice do you have in this?
Oh, as a manager, we don't have voice in it. If you are transporter of the product, then you can say something. But a manager of a station, we are not involved in those things.
Mr. Apa, thank you. Elton, so you understand where we are headed to gradually. He has said emphatically that by end of day today, if they don't get fresh supplies, come tomorrow, they're going to run out. What that means is that for motorists who buy fuel at this particular Guava station here in Nima, this place essentially will be closed to business. You cannot get fuel at this particular fuel station if the tanker drivers do not call off their industrial action. I'm just trying to engage some of these motorists if indeed they are aware of the situation and how prepared they are in the event that we have this shortage at the various pumps across the country. Let me engage this motorist first of all to find out what he makes of the situation. You're welcome to join you, sir. You're welcome to join us here. I just want to pick your brain on the ongoing industrial action by these tanker drivers. We've just heard from the manager of this Goyle station that by tomorrow, if they don't have supply from these tanker drivers, they could run out. Okay. Unfortunately, he says he's running late. Let me see if we could get a word from this Kia driver. He just pulled up. Hello, you're welcome to join us, sir.
Thank you, sir. You're welcome.
So we are just heard from the manager of this station that come tomorrow, if the strike action by the tanker drivers continues, he's going to run out. It means people like you, when you come here tomorrow, you're not going to have any suppliers. How concerned are you that there's going to be this shortage?
It worries, because this environment, this only in the police station we have around here. So going shortage, it worries more.
So what do you have to say to the tanker drivers?
They have to continue their work. They have to talk to their bosses and anything, they have to sort it out and continue their work.
So this is one. He's a motorist. Clearly, this is going to affect him if the situation is not resolved. And so he's also adding his voice, making the appeal to the tanker drivers to come to a compromise so that supplies will be taken across the country to avert any situation where there would be fuel shortage across the country because of the dire consequence this could have on the nation. It could bring this economy to a standstill, and that is what the authorities must work to avert. Elton.
Max Latif with Juice, and Latif is reporting live.
from the Nima roundabout Goyo filling station. Now let me bring in Sunday Alabi. He's the vice chair of the National Petroleum Tankers Drivers Union. Mr. Alabi, I guess you can hear me loud and clear now. Right, so you heard from the ground. I mean, one of our reporters reporting from Nima, and this Goyo fuel station says that if by close of work today they don't get supply, they'll run out of fuel tomorrow. I guess this is what you anticipate your strike action will bring.
That's not what we want, but there's nothing we can do about it now. Well, we are just fighting for our people to have a nice salary and a nice livelihood. Live on. That is why we're back on this.
So, if I may ask, I mean, you started this action on Monday. Has there been any overtures from the MPA, government, the OMCs, your owners, to have this matter resolved? We understand there's an ongoing meeting at the MPA.
Yes, we are hot inside to make it up to speak. After this meeting, before we know what is happening, will come out on the meeting. Because as we are in the meeting, we just want the framework to work on to be implemented. Because there are several things in this framework, the end of service benefits, insurance issues, hospital issues, and road expenses issues. So we are just expecting them to agree on this framework, because the guideline of the procedure, like the study of.
We've lost the connection to Mr. Alabi. Mr. Alabi, can you hear me?
Oh.
Yes, please go on.
Oh.
I think we'll see if we can get him on a regular telephone line so that we can have this conversation. But let me cross over to Kumasi to speak to my colleague Nana Yao Watiyada, who's also joining us to tell us the situation in the Garden City. Nana Watiyada, what can you report?
Well, Elton, today we've made stops at some fuel stations in the Ashanti region. Most of them are suffering due to the ongoing industrial action by these tanker drivers union. Well, yesterday the reports that we did file indicates that the tanker drivers are unwilling to resume work up until their demands are met. They are still in talks with government, and so in any moment from now they are expecting a resolution. But then our texts do indicate that these fuel stations, most of them that we did visit today, are suffering from the ongoing strike by these tanker drivers. Some fuel stations, including Shell, they tell us that they are starting to experience some shortages because of the strike action. The strike, they have some fuel in stock, but then if there's no resolution within the next 24 hours, they are likely to run out of fuel. In this case, most motorists or car users would have to drive in to purchase fuel, even though they do not have their tank empty. But then, considering the nature of the strike, if it exceeds 24 hours and even eats into the following week or the upcoming week, which is Monday, these fuel stations are likely to experience some fuel shortages, which is going to affect their businesses. When we did visit Total this very afternoon, they tell us that their stations have started calling them to report on some shortages that they are starting to experience as a result of this strike by these tanker drivers. And so clearly, from our observations, we can see that the strike is really biting hard on some of these fuel stations in the Ashanti region, Elton.
But no queues as of now.
As of now, there's nothing of that nature.
Namaste, thank you very much. Let me again bring in Sunday Alabi for the last time to see if you can hear me. Ms. Alabi, so what will get you to call off the strike?
We are here to have a meeting. And after that meeting, you see the outcome of the meeting. Oh, you know what to say.
So what? You want to see some documents signed, binding, before you walk out and say that we are resuming work?
Yes, that's exactly what we want to see.
And then the other matter is about the OMCs, you know, the position they've taken. And they say that it is not the responsibility of the MPA to determine salaries or even pay you. Some of the owners of the plant say that they are paying their workers, so they are very much taken aback with this decision taken by the union.
It's something we can say, but we are feeling the heat. So what we are saying is that it depends on their stand. Because if 10% are paying, 90% are paying, we are not able to help us. That is why it's not something that we pay us directly. We have a market in the nuclear fuel price going up. That's what we want to take away from our office and put to the other direction. So the policies have no hands in this. We don't know why they are objecting to this framework. Because what we believe is that there are procedures in there and policies in there that will protect from NPDA procedures and those regulations that will put into the framework. The policies need to go back. That is what we are running away from. That is why this has been made again.
So your numbers, this only drivers or drivers maize, all of them included in this package?
Yes, the drivers and the maize all are in our home now.
And in terms of numbers, how many are we looking?
Drivers and maize, about 10,000 people.
About 10,000, you want them paid?
Yes.
And you're only looking at salary and SNIT contribution, or there are other demands that you want?
The salary, the investment, insurance issues, end of year service package, any issues, and then every rules and regulations are part of it. One of those is get the driver. You have to speak. Our members that are off duty, our on retirement, 40% are very ill. And the union that is put there on them, but there's nothing to guide them after your end of service.
So until you get an agreement that you like and respect, this strike will continue.
Yes, it will surely continue.
All right, thank you very much. And if I may ask again, what time is this meeting starting?
I mean, anything is going to speak. So after having this interview, I have 40.
All right, Sunday Alabi, we'll reach out to you after the meeting to see if you manage to, address the concerns and move forward on this matter so that this does not escalate into something that we are not prepared for. Thank you very much. And so, Sunday Alabi is the vice chair of the Tanker Drivers Union, and they are now entering into a meeting with the National Petroleum Authority to discuss their issues of salaries, SNIT, and other conditions of service. So their members are in their 10,000s, and they want all of them paid through a structured system, not what exists now, where the owners pay them whatever they want. They think that it is not the best. And already we are getting reports from even here in the capital city of Accra, just around Nima here, where a oil filling station, they've made it clear that by close of work today, if they don't get supply tomorrow, there will be no fuel. And that, I'm sure, is going to be a picture you are likely to see, no fuel in some of these fuel stations if the strike continues, and we are keeping an eye on this matter very much. Now, some young girls in Ghana are trading sex for money to be able to purchase sanitary towels. This devastating revelation comes from a survey conducted by SEND Ghana, a non-governmental organization whose research has revealed that some ladies in some parts of the northern Ghana, southern, and some coastal areas cannot afford sanitary pad, and they engage in sexual activity. There's more in this report.
According to a 2023 BBC study in six African countries, a woman in Ghana earning a minimum wage of $26 a month would have to spend $3, or one in every $7 they make, to buy two packets of sanitary towels. That means for every 80 cedis they earn, they have to spend 11 cedis on pads alone. A later study by SEND Ghana also reveals 70% of young ladies in the country are unable to afford pads because they are expensive, forcing them to exchange money for them. Patricia Akwa is a student activist and member of SEND Ghana's research team.
The findings that blew my mind was where girls have to go in to have sex with their male counterparts for them to get money to buy this sanitary product, because I never knew this was really happening in some communities. So we got to the grounds and then realized that So this is really happening in some communities where other people can easily afford, not everyone, but then other people have to put their lives at risk by having sex, where they are exposed to a whole lot of risks like STIs and then UTIs. But then because they have to use the pad, they have no option than go in for the sex and then get the money.
Working under the theme, Sim Ghana shared the findings of their research report. Key among the findings were that to help curb this situation, they want taxes on sanitary pads to be scrapped and for the products to be reclassified from a luxury product to essential medical need. Also, that government in collaboration with GES should intervene by providing sanitary pads in schools.
Our recommendations are very simple and straightforward. If disposable sanitary pads are expensive and it is caused by taxes imposed on them, scrap off the taxes. Because when you do that, it will help reduce the prices for them. And the government has classified them as luxurious goods, something which is a natural phenomenon. It shouldn't be classified. It's not a car. So the taxes being reduced is one of the ways. And secondly, it should be reclassified and be called as a necessity, essential necessity materials for them. I believe that when we see them in that prospect, that they are medical necessities and they are very essential, it will help them as the reclassification goes on, reduce the taxes too. So if we can share sales books freely, we can share sanitary pads freely to them so that they will feel that comfort when they are going to school.
Period poverty is having negative effects on young ladies psychologically and in their education and to some extent their social lives. Sim Ghana, working under the theme Menstrual Silence, unveiling the hidden struggles among adolescent girls in Ghana, is calling on all stakeholders to join in the fight to liberate young ladies from this canker.
So joining us for more on this is Latifa Abdulhadi. Latifa, you're welcome. And of course, Isaac Jetro, youth advocate and researcher. Isaac, you're also welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what did you find in this search? I mean, alarming outcome, people trading sex for sanitary pad.
Okay, so I'm sure that someone somewhere might feel that we were just saying it,
yeah,
or it's just something that's okay to us, but we were on the field. We administered questionnaires, we had face-to-face interviews, and then we had some key informant interviews too. So during those interviews, we spoke to some of the girls, and then they told us that sometimes that is what they have to do in order to be able to purchase a sanitary pad.
So therefore, they are left on their own around these periods?
Yes, yes, they are. Because let's say a household income is like 50 cedis or 100 cedis a month, and then they have three or more female children and they are all menstruating in the same month. And now a sanitary pad costs 17 cedis, 18 cedis, and some are even 20 cedis. So a household that has an income of 100 cedis needs to buy like three different sanitary pads for their three females. It's a difficult thing to do. So if their parents are not able to provide for them, they tend to fall on that other measure to be able to get a sanitary pad.
Yeah, so Jetro, is basically about affordability.
Yes.
And the fact that their parents are unable to afford it.
Yes.
So how you treat yourself during that menstruation period is entirely your business. Is that what you uncovered?
And some parents actually said that when they are having difficulties in providing and the girl child comes home, brings a sanitary pad home, it's glory to God, because they realize they are helping them reduce some of their financial burden. And as to how they got the money to buy, they don't really find out. Because at the end of the day, what we need...
It probably will be quite obvious to them.
Yes, and a young lady said if her mother has already budgeted for what to buy with the money in the house, I mean, budget is closed. And unfortunately, she realized she's menstruating. And the mother have to use the food money to buy sanitary pad. And it's not possible to go hungry and use money to buy sanitary pad. Mm-hmm. So they rather go out and then do what they have to do to get the money to buy the sanitary pad because it's needed. So that's what goes on.
And I guess this is more pronounced in poverty endemic areas? Because I've looked at the regions that, I mean, you brought these findings, and basically the coastal and the other areas. So for urban areas, the situation might be different. Is that the case?
Okay, I'll not say like very, or maybe there's a vast difference, but then it is a little bit better. Because during our interview in the northern region, there was a village we had this interview in, and then we realized that because of how expensive sanitary pad is, there is this store, a provision store, that sells one piece.
Just one out of the
just
pack.
Just one, yes. They just remove them one. They sell it for one cedis in the northern region. But
my understanding is that for a lady to have a very, to have it in a more comfortable way, you might have to change it like 3 times in a day.
Yes.
Yeah. And so maybe 3 times, five days of the week, then you are talking about 15.
15 cedis.
Yes, and then how, and then the affordability become an issue.
Yes, please.
And so for such people, if they are unable to afford and they don't want to engage in sex in return for sanitary pad, how do they survive during the, did you get that information too?
It will amaze you to know that some people go as far as using socks to absorb their menstrual blood. Shocking, right?
Right.
But it's happening. Some people use socks, others use rags, and others even use leaves.
Leaves, grass.
Leaves to absorb their menstrual blood.
So the situation is becoming very expensive.
Very, very expensive.
For a lot of young ladies.
Some parents are able to tell you that the disposable sanitary pad is what they need because that is quality and helps. But if she is not able to buy for the adolescent girl, she goes to cut her clean, and they term it clean clothes for them to use. And you don't know how clean that will be.
Mm.
And with that, they can't even go to school because it might shake, it might shift, and they will stain themselves. And that brings in stigma and other related issues. Mm. So they are able to stay home, and they are missing school. School, some of them go to school and low concentration. And it's affecting their education. Because we're looking at period poverty, we are not only looking at the affordability of the menstrual product. We are looking at wash facilities and the education as well.
Mm.
So even if there is affordability of menstrual product and there is no wash facility, there is no better education, educating them, we are still poor in terms of their period. And these are these three findings we notice in this 6th district that we lack in all these three. So it looks like Ghana is purely periodically poor. That's too serious.
We'll come back to recommendations going forward. But I just also want to find out, in researching into this, I mean, has there been pregnancy as a result of people engaging in what they thought was good for them to keep their personal hygiene? Has there been reported pregnancies as a result?
Yes, there has been a whole lot. Because when you fall on that measure, I mean, like a man buying sanitary pad for you when you're on your period, and then he demands for sex in return, it is possible for you to get pregnant when you have sex, or when you don't even have knowledge that you need to protect yourself in order not to get pregnant and all. We reported some cases like that. Yes,
and people are also refusing to go to school because of the stigma that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, because when the clothes are not really, should I say, durable, if that is the right word, because when you use a cloth, it can shift, and then you can stain yourself. And when you stain yourself and someone sees it, you might be made fun of. So people avoid going to school when they are on their periods till they are done because of the stigma.
So the end game to this exercise is what?
Well, like we rightly said yesterday, we know that the import duties, that is 20%, and the VAT 15%, has a hand in this, and the high cost of living, because if you can't buy it, you can't use it. So we are calling on the government to scrap off the taxes.
I think my viewers are saying that they can barely hear you, so if you can speak up small for
them. So we want the government to scrap off the taxes on the sanitary products for the adolescent girl to be able, because about 95% of our research stated that that is what they use, because it helps them avoid washing blood. And when they use a reusable, they need to wash. So if the government scrap off the tax, they will be able to purchase. And aside the scrapping off of the taxes, we are asking government to also look at the infrastructure aspect of it, that's the water, sanitation, and hygiene. Mm-hmm. You realize you go to schools and only about 33% said they have this wash facilities in their school. And even with
most schools, there's none.
There's none. And even with the schools who have the wash facilities, it's not conducive.
Mm-hmm.
One school stated that they had a janitor who used to work and it was running, but government is not able to pay her anymore, so it's closed down.
So they're on their own?
They're on their own. So a girl will come to school, and if she's menstruating, teacher will say she finds her own way of changing. And that's not conducive enough. And others who have it too do not have water flowing, no dustbins, nothing to help them when they are menstruating and they go to school.
Mm.
So she rather prefer to stay home. So when they improvise the infrastructures and then build more, change rooms, and then build separate washrooms for them. Because I can't feel comfortable changing and a guy badges in. So they have separate change rooms. And with the education aspect, realize about 77% said they heard of it before their first menac or their first menses.
Mm.
But yet realize it never translated into they keeping themselves clean.
Mm.
Because it was as a result of telling them, when you get to this age, you start menstruating. But how to take care of themselves? The table or the research made us understand that teachers did well in explaining to them,
okay,
but followed by mothers.
Mm-hmm.
But it will shock you that on the scale of 0 to 10, fathers played a 0.3% of educating the adolescent girls on menstruation.
They consider it the mother's business.
And that was a statement a man made, that when they are menstruating, ask them to go to their mother because it's a woman's business.
Mm.
And this is not true. That's the education aspect. And we link it to misconceptions and myths and attribute them to taboos and all these things. That menstruation is dirty, it is shameful, and that you can't even cook at home. So all these things. So we're asking that there should be more sensitization,
mm-hmm,
and then more training. We should allow the teachers teach it. If they are not, they should start teaching it in school.
Mm-hmm.
It should be part of their career.
The matter you raised issue about the 20% tax on imported sanitary pad. Remember that governments give special dispensation to companies that are manufacturing it locally.
Sure.
And I don't know whether your checks also looked at that to look at the affordability aspect of it. Because if you are not, if the tax is on importation, and then the local industry said that we can meet demand, the question is about cost and whether the people can afford.
So we've heard of the zero tax,
right,
on the locally imports, and then ways that want to scrap off to help. But that was on paper. The implementation, we've heard it's been made, but practically, countries are still expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So until we see, so it's one of our recommendations,
mm-hmm,
that the Ministry of Finance and the NGRA should speed up the implementation process. If it has been, there should be an evaluation stage where we will know prices have been. Until then, we can't stop campaigning for a reduction.
But let me find, are there other recommendations you want to share with us? Plus also, what role you think that parents must do in these circumstances?
Okay, so adding up on the recommendations, we believe the government should, like, give sanitary pads to school. There should be sanitary pads in school, like in their first aid boxes, mm-hmm, because period is just something that can happen to any girl at any time, and we might not know when it will come. So it should be part of the first aid boxes in school. And then I believe the parents...
Every school?
Yes, every school. It should be free.
Mm-hmm.
Free. Every school should have access to sanitary pads. And then I believe parents should shy away from the fact that they don't want to talk to their kids, especially the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk to their kids about menstruation and personal hygiene. Because I believe if parents really talk to their kids about menstruation and menstrual hygiene, the teachers wouldn't even need to come in, or they wouldn't have to depend on their friends for information. Mm-hmm. And some of these informations are not even accurate.
Right.
So, yeah.
Jethro, how the final word?
In calling on the government, I think we all have a role to play. The media, individuals, the religious bodies. If we are able to speak about LGBTQI in our churches, we can equally educate people on this as well.
Mm.
Let us all put hands together. I was like that initially. I couldn't talk about these issues.
Yeah.
But when you have the education, more of sensitization, we will know that there are issues that we all have to come on board. So if the whole population will put hands together, I think we can all fight this and fight it in the right direction.
All right, Joshua and Hadi, thank you very much for passing through. the pause this afternoon. Now, we are not done yet. Now, let me take you across the borders of Ghana, because a trial against a group of German nationals accused of trying to overthrow the government has begun in Frankfurt. The suspects are part of a far-right movement known as the Wiesenberger. DW correspondent Emily Leschner joins us with the story from Berlin. So, Emily, tell us about who is on trial and what they were allegedly planning to do.
The defendants in this case are accused of being the ringleaders of a plan to overthrow Germany's government, a plan that allegedly included storming parliament and detaining high-ranking politicians like Chancellor Olaf Scholz, as well as Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock and an opposition leader. There were also plans for a violent takeover of the main small arms supplier to Germany's military. And they're facing charges of treason and belonging to a terrorist organization. There are also two other trials linked to this alleged coup attempt, one that began at the end of last month against the so-called military arm of Reichsbürger, and another that is scheduled to begin in June against alleged associates of Reichsbürger.
How is Reichsbürger movement different from other far-right groups?
Is a network more than it is a group. Its members believe that Germany is a deep state run by foreign entities. And though it's technically leaderless, there is one man who's at the helm of the movement. That's Heinrich VIII, Prince Royce, a 72-year-old estate agent who descends from one of Germany's aristocratic families, which German officials say Reichsbürger supporters had earmarked as the leader of the German state had this alleged coup taken place and been successful. Reichsbürger translates to citizens of the Reich. Those who support it deny the legitimacy of Germany's post-World War II Federal Republic. And the fundamental belief underpinning this group or this movement is a rejection of Germany's constitution, its legal system, as well as its institutions. And Reichsbürger supporters have even produced some of their own aspirational documents like passports and driving licenses. And Germany's federal prosecutor says they had plan to renegotiate a treaty with World War II allies, including Russia.
So how big is this movement in Germany?
German intelligence officials say there are between 20 and 23,000 people in the country who pledge allegiance to the Reichsbürger. The average Reichsbürger supporter is 50 years old, male, and socially and financially disadvantaged. And though, of course, there are some prominent members who are outside this average, like Heinrich Reuss, and the woman who was earmarked to serve as the justice minister after the coup attempt. That's Birgit Masack-Winkemann, a former judge and a representative of the far-right AfD party in federal parliament. Along with Royce, she's one of the 10 defendants currently standing trial in Frankfurt.
All right, thank you very much, Emily Leschner from our partners at DW TV in Germany. Well, that's our show for today. Tomorrow, same time, Friday, we'll be here with a Friday edition of The Pulse here on Joy News. My name is Elton Grobet. Whatever you are up to in the hours ahead, I hope it's profitable. This morning, the chairman of the NDC, Joseph Asiedu Nketiah, sat down with my colleague Benjamin Kapo, and he spoke about a lot more issues. I will leave you with that.
In this morning, with none other than the chairman of the National Democratic Congress, in the person of Johnson Asiedu Nketiah. I don't know whether it's still up to call him General Mosquito. It is General Secretary Days and General, but now I don't know whether we should shift to Chairman.
Good morning. Good morning, my brother.
And thanks for coming.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I cannot help but start the conversation right here. We should have started this conversation a long time ago,
yes.
Thanks to the power outage. And yes, we do have systems in place, but even the systems were affected, and we're now starting with this conversation. What has been your experience with Doomsong so far? CSC?
Well, maybe it may not be all about Doomsong, but I've gotten used to my programs being interrupted in like manner in other studios. So maybe it is Doomsong, maybe it is something else, but I don't know. Whatever the case is, we thank God that we are back on air, so we can continue the program.
Well, good to have you. But let's just do this. How healthy is the MDC as of today? And I ask this from the position of, if elections were held today in Ghana, presidential, parliamentary, how do you think the MDC would fare? How healthy is your...
Well, if free and fair elections were held today, we win hands down, one touch. There will be no runoff at all. Our concern is about how to secure free and fair elections. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are focusing now, because our message has been accepted. The two parties have been tried. There are opinion polls that have been churned out, and everything points to a one-third victory for NDC. But as has been said by some Russian president, that those who vote decide nothing, and those who count the votes decide everything. So we are focusing on those who will be counting the votes and those who will be providing security to make sure that elections proceed uninterrupted. So that's where our focus is now.
And you're saying basically that if elections were held today, let's take away the other factors, and I'll get into them, I'll peel them like onions, layer.
Yes.
But on what basis would you say that your party would have a one-touch victory? Some of these polls, you know that polls are relative. Polls can disappoint. We saw polls go horribly wrong when Trump became president. We've seen polls fall through in the past. Are you relying on polls? Do you really have the numbers? Or are you just figuring it's an 8-year cycle we have had, and so it's our turn again?
I think that however faulty polls are, they are better than guesswork.
Mm.
So we haven't voted today. So you are asking us to project. And I'm saying that we have projected the results to be this way. It is either just guesswork or guesswork supported by something. Right. And in this case, our guesswork is supported by scientific data that has been collected on the field. That's why we are confident. Besides our own internal polls, there are outside credible polls that seem to confirm what we have gathered. So that is a source of our confidence.
I was about to go there and ask you that. I mean, the likes of Global Info Analytics and others have put out polls there which seem to suggest that the former president, John Dramani Mahama, may have some sort of lead over his counterpart in the MPP. But you say you've conducted your own internal polls as well.
That's why
how often are you doing them? How often are you conducting them? And what are they revealing? Are they revealing anything different from or better than what Global Info
Analytics? They are for internal consumption, but they are very consistent with what Global Info Analytics is bringing out.
So can you give me a ballpark figure of per your last poll, if elections were conducted, what margins?
They are winning 52%. As at this month, if elections, free and fair elections were conducted, we should win 52%, and that would be a one-time
per your internal poll.
Sure.
Let me come to this though. Do you feel that the 52% that is being reflected in all of that is because the NDC has performed better than the MPP comparatively? Whether the NDC is a better choice or simply because the MPP has been so bad, has been woeful, for which reason the NDC is an alternative. What do you think?
All of those. the fact that you have mentioned.
All of them.
Because there are people who think that, well, we don't, I think NDC is a better option because of the woeful performance of MPP.
Right.
They are the people who believe that bad becomes good when the worst happens.
Mm.
So you have people who did not support NDC in any way at all, but they've seen MPP perform, so it makes NDC looks good. There is that group of people.
Yeah.
There is another group that thinks that NDC has been good all along, but MPP succeeded in projecting NDC as a bad, you know, system. And they use media, social media, lies, half-truths and all that to project NDC as a bad system. And now their own lies are catching up with them. So the truth is emerging, and that has vindicated every step that NDC has taken, which has been classified as bad, to be the right thing that should be that we should be doing. And so that's why I'm saying all that. Everybody has a reason. And then, finally, there are those who think that whatever happens,
right,
we are under some form of misgovernance. So let us remove the government before we even think about who will replace that government. Because whatever happens, the bottom line is that the nation is under some siege. The nation is the nation has been hijacked. Our institutions have all been reconfigured to serve personal interests instead of public interest. So let's get rid of this bad system before we even figure out who will take over.
But that's also an interesting aspect. It's like taking a leap of sense versus a leap of faith. Faith will tell us that take a leap of faith, but sometimes jumping into the unknown could be disastrous.
And that is what we are trying to avoid. Because, you see, when you have a bad system in place, then everybody thinks that any other thing is better than what we have.
Mm.
And so, without thinking about what the possible replacement is, they'll be going in. And that's how, in the past, some dictators have been produced.
Right.
If you go to Italy, that was how Mussolini was produced. You go to Germany, that's how Hitler was produced.
Mm.
And so we have a risk that if we are unable to rescue this system and we continue, the next leader who will be produced may be worse than anything at all. That is why we think that at least we have seen the work of President Mahama, and we have seen the work of NDC. We think that let us do everything to replace this government with President Mahama, and we will be in a safe pair of hands. Otherwise, the other alternative will be disastrous. And so, see, when people lose faith, not in just the government, but in life itself, and they think they don't have anything to lose, they become very, very dangerous to society. And indeed, it's been said that the most dangerous person in society is the one who doesn't have anything to lose.
Has nothing to lose.
That's the
point. But I find it interesting. Because I'm a student of politics, I'm reflecting on the words you're using.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about Benito Mussolini,
yeah,
who was a fascist leader.
Yes.
You're talking about Adolf Hitler,
yeah,
who was a Nazi leader.
Yeah.
At a point there will be a convergence with, yes, Italy, you know, supporting the Nazi effort.
Mm-hmm.
That is scary because you are talking about it relative to a democratic administration.
Mm.
Led by a human rights renowned lawyer. And should you be mentioning these things in the same breath? I find it scary almost that you're mentioning all of these
things. I think we are getting me wrong. I'm describing the situation that persisted before generated this type of leaders.
Mm.
And that is the situation I'm comparing with Nanado's administration. Mm. So if you are not able to change it and replace it with a better system, and we go a step further, it could be replaced by a fascist or a worse kind of dictator.
And you feel that is where we are
That is where we are heading into. So we have this window to pass through. If it gets closed, then we are doomed.
I see.
Mm.
Let
let's talk about, I mean, your party in terms of gearing up for the 2024 elections. And we'll talk about the EC, yes. But in Kuranza South recently, there was a claim by some MPP members that your parliamentary candidate should behave, else, I mean, there could be some incidents in there. Then we've seen the limited voter registration exercise and the skirmishes that have characterized it in some instances where some of your party people have also been complicit. Arrests have been made, yes, then claims that this person was not even on the scene. But how are you from your end, especially as political party vigilantism must be swept aside, how are you cooperating as a party on that end to ensure peaceful elections?
You see, it is always very important for a credible media house like Joy to get your stories directly from the source so that you will not be influenced by what other people say. Mm-hmm. And that is why, because the issues you are talking about, the Kwanzaa issue, the what do you call it?
I'm just reechoing the threat or what has been said from the MPP caucus.
That's why I'm saying that if you had somebody there reporting to you what is happening there, what actually is happening there, you see those who are shedding crocodile tears. And those who are facing the truth.
So what's
the truth in Kwanzaa South is that, you know, Basim is against electoral laws. You cannot hide a Basim.
Yes. Basim is against electoral laws.
Sure, it's there. You cannot go and load people in the bus, drive them to a registration center or a voting center and say that these are my people, get them registered, get down and join the queue. It's against the laws.
That is what the police
is not enforcing, and it is creating this problem. Or that is what they may be enforcing partially. That is creating these problems. You understand? So, if we stick by the law, everything else, our electoral laws are so designed to create peace. The problem is that those who are to implement the laws or those who are to enforce the laws are not doing the right things. And that is why you have this chaos. For instance, in Kwanzaa North, where you think MPP, you say you heard MPP complaining. You go
in South,
in Kwanzaa South. You are busing people straight from Ashanti region who are non-Nkwanza indigents to go and register.
And you have proof of that?
Yes, there's proof of that. And the people, citizens there, it's not as if NDC has gone there to organize.